teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey guys, Anna David with After Party Pod here, podcast about addiction recovery. Today, it's also a podcast about writing a movie based on your own experiences with a friend you met in rehab when your dad is Rob Reiner. We're going to get to that in 2 seconds. What else am I going to tell you? If you're new to the podcast, welcome. So glad you're here. You're obviously interested in addiction and recovery. If you're not at all interested, first of all, it's a fascinating topic, so I'm not sure what's up with you. But second of all, I guess stop listening. Otherwise, keep listening. You guys have been sending awesome emails, and I'm so grateful for every single one of them. So please keep doing that if you are so inspired. Anna@theafterpartygroup.com. And what is the After Party Group, you may ask? You're just like, I'm listening to an After Party Pod. Well, the group also comprises the website After Party Magazine, a website that I edit that posts 12 stories a day about addiction and recovery, many rehab reviews. If you are looking for a rehab, go to rehabreviews.com. That's our parent company. And we talk a lot about rehabs in this episode because my guest, one of my guests, Nick Reiner, has been to 17 of them. And both Matt, his co-writer, Nick, and I are proud alumni of Promises, fondly known as Ghetto Promises because it's not the fancy one in Malibu, but the one in Mar Vista, and get into that in a second. If you would like to find out about these podcasts and get information from the After Party Group, sign up for afterpartynewsletter.com, and you'll also get a free copy of our ebook, How I Got Sober. It's 10 addict stories of how they found recovery. It's funny, it's good, it's real. You'll laugh, you'll cry, possibly. And that's pretty much it. Now I'm going to get into the guests, Nick Reiner and Matt Elisafan. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. I'm bad at pronunciation. They are the co-writers of Being Charlie, a new film released May 6th. If I release this podcast exactly when I think I plan to, it will have been last week. It is a movie that Matt and Nick wrote after meeting in rehab at Ghetto Promises, and they started writing, and they thought they were writing longhand. They thought they were writing a TV show. It turned into a movie. Nick's dad, Rob Reiner, ended up being the director, and it's now out. Now, if you don't know who Rob Reiner is, then I'm not sure what to tell you. He directed basically the most important movies of my youth, including The Princess Bride, Stand By Me, The Sure Thing, which is a movie not as many people talk about, which was just epic. You know how, I don't know, I grew up in the dark ages and we had these things called VHS tapes. But I think every family had some version of this. The Sure Thing was one of the four tapes that we owned and watched over and over and over again. The other ones were Foul Play with Goldie Hawn and Chevy Chase. Fabulous movie. It was shot in Marin County where I was raised, so I think that's why we watched it over and over again. Also, Pride and Prejudice with Olivier, because my mom is an English professor, and Pride and Prejudice was her favorite book, and she was writing her dissertation on Jane Austen, and there were a couple of 16 Candles. There were a couple others, but anyway, this is a movie that's wonderful. It is about Nick and Matt's experiences with addiction and recovery. Nick's experiences are pretty dramatic, as I said. Went through 17 rehabs, starting at the age of 14. There were bouts of homelessness. And, you know, and obviously people are fascinated by this story because here he grew up in the heart of Hollywood with a famous director dad. And they get into that in the movie. Carrie Elwes, who of course starred in The Princess Bride, plays the dad in it. And so there's a lot of father, son, and he plays a movie star turned politician. And so anybody watching it is obviously going to think that the stories are exactly Nick and Rob Reiner stories, which it's, of course it's not. We get into all of that in the episode. So I'm going to stop summarizing what these guys said, and I'm going to give you Nick Reiner and Matt Elisafan if I'm pronouncing that right.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God, I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
First of all, congratulations on the movie. It's
Thank
very
you.
Exciting.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. And we can just, that was such a bizarre beginning. Let's just talk about how my listeners know James because he's helped me set up before. And he said he knew you, but I didn't understand it was going to be this joyful reunion.
Well, James is an amazing man, and seeing him again put a smile on my face. So, yeah, it started off really great, this podcast, to see James again.
Let's keep it going, because the listeners didn't get to hear how... Literally, you were, like, uproariously laughing and hugging.
What do you think of James?
I've actually heard a lot about James.
Shut up! You
like,
have?
He's, like, a legend, and Nick and Joey, his friend, have told me a lot about him, and he was exactly as advertised. So he did not let down at all. In fact, he might have exceeded expectations.
What's amazing is he's actually going to listen to this episode because I can tell him the beginning was all about him, which has never happened.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yeah, they told me all the hijinks that they would get into with him. And yeah,
he's a
listener. It's great to put a face to that.
That James Michael Marshall, go Google the guy or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, let's go back to you guys. So this movie, Being Charlie, is coming out in May, correct?
Yeah.
And you guys met in treatment. And what I understand is that basically, Nick, you saw Matt kind of do some kind of a stand-up comedy, sort of like what's in the movie. And that's when you said, like, that's the guy I want to write something with. Is that what happened?
That's the movie version of it. But I did see him do stand-up. I did we did start talking after that. It did take a while to get going, actually, on the script. So it wasn't that beat for beat. But we definitely, like, found some common ground. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. What was your...
Yeah, I mean, he was, like, I mean, we were both just disgruntled people who didn't really talk to each other and were kind of pissed that we were there. And then, you know, we kind of... That was a good common denominator for us. Icebreaker, exactly.
Right, right.
And then we ended up just being roommates. Like, they paired us together.
That's
so,
what really sealed
it. Yeah, that was we went into that big house together.
And we had a guy to make fun of the whole time.
Okay, wait, hold the mic up while you talk about the guy that you had to make fun of all the time. Someone you were in treatment with.
Well, yeah, we had a common...
enemy.
Yeah, this guy was not really mean-spirited. He just kind of was hilarious in the way that he talked and the things that he said. Yeah. And he was definitely – we tried to satirize him, but we needed the actual guy to play the part. So we just
– Yeah, and his name was – no. Yeah. Oh, my God. Don't –
So that was one of the jokes about him, email.com?
Well,
maybe you had
know,
to be there to think that's fucking kidding.
Well, he didn't know his email, like, because I remember I had to help him log into Facebook, and I was like, and I think he might have been illiterate, but he was just like, he called me in one day, because he followed me to that. I thought I was done with him, but then he was at the same halfway house, and this might not, you can cut all this if it doesn't work. But
it's all good.
Oh, he was like, Matt, like, come over here. And I was like, okay. He's like, what the fuck is this? And we were at the halfway house computer, and it says on Facebook, you forgot your password. And I was like, you forgot your password. Uh-huh. He's like, no, I didn't. I was like, well, Facebook disagrees with you. He's like, well, now what the fuck do I do? And he was this, like, scrawny white kid. Oh, yeah, he was a scrawny white kid from Seattle. And I was like, so I was like, click the thing that says forgot your password, and he – And it says, what's your email? And he's like, and he hesitated, and he wrote his name and then at email.com. And I was like, and then one time he was talking to his parents, and he was telling them about his day on the phone. We heard him say, like, yeah, so then one day, so we woke up, we had breakfast, and then we had lunch. And then he went turning to Nick. He's like, and then we went to the seafood. Hey, Nick, what was the name of that seafood joint we went to? And we had been to the aquarium. And he was like, you mean the aquarium? He's like, yeah, the aquarium. That place was dope. And like, so we just – and that's just one or two stories. And we really had a good time. I mean, maybe that's insensitive laughing about
– Look, whatever gets you through treatment,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The site that this podcast is a part of, we actually review rehabs. So I literally know the names of all of them. I went to Promises, but back in 1999, and I didn't go to the fancy one. I went to through Promises? Yes.
That's the one where we met.
Shut up.
Can I say that?
Of course you can say that.
Okay.
While you say that, no one ever go to Burning Tree
No. We can't try.
We can't try? I thought you said review them.
Well,
you review. I mean, that's what reviewers do.
True. Okay, so Burning Tree didn't work out for you.
No, it didn't help me in my recovery. Neither did Alina Lodge.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah,
not to defame any of those places.
But Promises, as we fondly called, we called it Ghetto Promises back then, just because I thought I was at the super fancy one, and I sort of walked around and was like, so nice the way they hide the movie stars in the pool, and people are like, no, you're at the other Promises.
We were at the shitty one.
Yeah.
The nice one's in Malibu.
Yeah.
And this one was, nice, but it wasn't.
It wasn't in 1999, I'll tell you that.
It was the nicest one I had been to at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, yeah.
Just the freedom.
Yeah.
So
I was like, where's Lindsay Lohan? Where's Lindsay at?
Right, exactly.
She's in Malibu.
Yeah, the nice one. No, it was like a
She'll be here in 3 days.
Yeah. Exactly. So, okay, but so you, I know that you went through treatment. How many times did you go, Nick?
Ballpark 18, something like that.
Is that true? 18?
Yeah, it is true, unfortunately.
So from what age to what age?
From 14, 15 to 19.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you were never not in treatment, basically, during those years, except when you were out.
You could say that, yeah. And when I would get out, I'd be angry and rebel. And I don't know if going to that many places was a product of me being an actual drug addict or me being the most rebellious person ever, because I just wouldn't listen. I just never listened. And I was just like, I'm going to get, one over on people by, doing this crazy thing. And then... and then I would be getting one over done on me.
Right.
By having to go to another place.
Of those 18, how many did you get kicked out of?
I stayed the course way more than I should have at a lot of them. I only got kicked out of...
My only regret is that I didn't run away from more.
I did throw a rock through a window at a place.
Oh, like in the movie.
But that didn't get me kicked out. I was trying to prove I was crazy because they weren't giving me any medication.
Right.
And they were saying that, people don't need medication. And
to detox or just in general?
Just in general. And I was insane. And I said, I'm insane. And they said... No, you're not. And I said, okay. And then I was like, well, they're not taking my word for it. I might as well demonstrate what crazy is. And so I did that, yeah.
As a conscious move to get meds.
As a conscious move to be crazy, I think.
Right, yeah. Right. What and Matt, how many was that your one time in treatment or?
Yeah, I was a one and done.
Yeah,
as
me
they
too.
Say in
me
basketball.
Too. But that was a good treatment center, right?
I mean, I have nothing to compare it to.
Right, right. Except other people's stories.
I went to a halfway house after that, which was in the Promises sort of umbrella.
So like a sober living.
Yeah. Yeah, they call it sober living, and I was super excited. They're like, wait till you get to – they build up sober living so much. Like, wait, Matt, wait till you get to sober living. Oh, my God, sober living. And then I was like – I called my friend. I was like, I'm on my way to sober living. And he was just like – oh, you mean you're going to halfway house? And I was like, no, it's sober living. It's like, it's like kind of like halfway between rehab and I was like, oh, fuck, it is a halfway house.
It always sounded to me, I didn't do sober living after, but a lot of the people I was in treatment with did. It sure sounds better than halfway house.
Yeah, it's a total
it's a
semantic
misnomer,
marketing
so they can charge
tool.
More.
Right, and because halfway house has a stigma. Sober living's like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
And how long did you stay in sober living?
I did a month in inpatient, a month in sober living, and then I did a month in outpatient, like in New York, that was like you met 3 times a week.
Right.
And meet you, or maybe even every day for an hour or two, and you had group discussions. And none of the people in the outpatient had been to rehab, so they were like complaining about having to go to a meeting for an hour a week. I was like, this is lightweight shit right here,
And so was that 3 years ago that you guys met at Promises?
5 years ago.
Oh, 5 years ago. Okay. And so then what was your trajectory after that? So you guys are roommates there at Promises. And did you have the idea to write the script then? It was a TV thing at that point, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we just decided that some of the stuff was like – we thought like there was a great – I mean, if you – I mean, a lot – all rehab is really is like –
listening to people's stories. And yeah, you just listen to stories, and you know, we started to see that there was like narrative in being like, I mean, I feel like narrative and sobriety are like so intertwined, and we just thought it'd be fun to, we didn't have any aspirations of any sort. I don't want to speak for both of us, but we just thought, we weren't allowed a lot of privileges in rehab, but we were allowed to, like, we couldn't go on the computer really. And so, but we were allowed notebooks. So right. we decided to, you know, start writing stuff down. And, you know, we started writing, you know, some scenes longhand, and it sort of grew from there.
And do you want to add or say he's totally wrong?
No, he's right. I mean, I had a little bit of a different trajectory than him. What I thought was cool was, like, he told me, like, instead of going after all the stuff he just said, after going to not going to AA meetings, he would instead go do stand-up because it was either an AA meeting or a stand-up class. And I always thought that was really interesting because he was, like, picking something he's really passionate about that would fulfill his life and his time.
Right.
But for me, I went straight back to doing bad things every time. And then which I think is the reason why we dropped the script for as long as we did, because I was kind of messing up for a long time, or fucking up. I forgot we could swear.
You can swear as much as you want.
And then we met back up in New York, mm-hmm. and we just started writing from there again. And yeah, I don't even know why I started opening my mouth, but
but so did. You guys had both been writers before that?
We were both, I guess we were like wise guys at the time. And then I'd studied English in college. I mean, to say that we were like, I mean, I was 20 and you were 18.
Ever tried to write a script or anything like that before?
I'd taken a class mm-hmm. in college at that point, mm-hmm. But that's it. It was sort of, we were learning as we went.
And, so how'd you guys both end up in New York? You guys both moved there after?
You're going to make me say that we were bi-coastal for a while.
Yeah, well, hey, and, why not? You went to the Bad Promises. At least you can say bi-coastal.
Oh, here we go. Okay, so I decided after messing up for a really long time, what am I going to do with my life? So I got a GED. Mm-hmm. I was about to go to this college in North Carolina, and the last minute, I was like, I don't really want to do this. And so I had spent, you know, 6 months preparing to get into this, like, really easy school to get into that was extremely hard for me to get into. Mm. And I decided not to go. And then I was in New York for, like, 3 days. And I remember Facebook messaging Matt, and we met at a bagel shop and started discussing the screenplay that we had written. And we were like, hey, I think we were onto something with that. And we were just like, oh, yeah, that one joke about this and that. And then we're like, let's go print it out. And we went upstairs and we printed it out, and we got through like a page, and we were like, this is trash. And then, you know, we were like, what would make this a little bit more serious? What would, like, have some of the jokes still, but like make it a little bit more adult, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting with your, you know, stand-up comedy, you wouldn't think you guys would write a drama necessarily, right?
Well, I think I like to think that we tried to approach it like we want to tell this story, and what's the best way to tell it. And
right.
I think in recovery, I mean, there's a lot of funny moments and there's a lot of sad moments, and just to cherry pick, this is going to be a comedy or this is going to be a drama, is like not doing service to like the breadth of like that experience.
Right.
Because I think, you know, I've laughed, some of the hardest I've ever laughed
right.
was in recovery, and, you know, the hardest I've ever cried has been in recovery right. too. So,
right.
I mean, I think we realized that we had to, we started it as a comedy, which I think comedy is like, one of the reasons it started as a comedy is because you want to deflect, and like comedy is a great way to deflect and like shimmy away from the thing, you know, it's a great way to be optimistic when you're miserable. But like,
right.
I think when we had some years on us, some seasoning, we were able to take a more objective, we were able to go more directly into the subject.
Yeah. Nick, you want to add anything?
I was just really drugged out when we started working together.
So everything seemed funny, or?
No, not everything seemed funny. Everything seemed miserable. But we were kind of just like, I had nothing going for me. And he sort of started to help me write and taught me how to use a comma. I had no idea how to do anything. And through working and working and working, I got sobered up. And I was like, you know, this is a better life than just running amok. And we just started like, what the stand-up was for him to kind of get sober, what the writing was for me, because I never really had that passion.
Right.
And so, and being Charlie, that's, we kind of appropriated our, you know, feelings towards having something like that into, yeah, instead of saying like, oh, this person goes to rehab, then goes to AA and has this huge, you know, enlightenment. It's like, what other things in your life get you to get on the straight and narrow? And for us, it was different things, you know, or the same thing.
So, but in treatment, the Promises takes you to meetings and all of that stuff. And do you guys still do that? Where are you on that?
Well, we went to pretty much every meeting out here in Promise, like, you know.
Yeah.
We did the whole 90 and 90, whatever.
Yeah.
And actually, I remember hating rehab so much that AA was the best part of my day.
Right.
You know, was where we, because you got, they let you out.
Right.
And they like, and it's like, oh my God, these are other people that are not wearing sweatpants and yeah. And so I actually loved going to AA. And then what Nick was saying earlier is, I remember when I got back to New York, it was like I had to decide, like a lot of the AA meetings were at the same time as the open mics that I wanted to hit, and I was always a conflict. And then eventually, I just sort of, I stopped going to meetings. I didn't think I needed. I don't know what I. I was. I mean, I was managed to stay sober.
Right.
You know? I mean, a lot of people will say, you know, well, you're white knuckling it, or you know, whatever. And
lot of people will say the op. You know, will say. I know a ton of people that don't go that seem to be doing just fine, and I know plenty of people. I mean, I love AA, but I know plenty of people in AA who don't seem to be doing just fine.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the reality.
That's refreshing to hear someone, because there are a lot of, you know,
people who tell you you're going to relapse if you don't go.
And,
you know?
You know, sometimes like I would go 2 weeks, you know, and then I'd go back and everyone's like, look what the cat dragged in. And I was like, no, I didn't drink. And they would be like, what?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, in any environment, there are diehard people who are going to preach their gospel, I think. And I think it's unfortunate that there are people in 12-step who do that, and then other people think everybody in 12-step is like that.
I think that, those bullies, though.
It's interesting. It really does depend, I think, on, it's like luck of the draw. It's funny, I just had a really weird experience at a meeting last week, but when I was new, I'm so grateful I never encountered anybody like that.
Really?
Yeah.
I attracted those people, but it was like, I'm getting bitched out by another drug addict that is like been sober for like a year and wants a medal for it. And it's like telling me what to do.
It's interesting. I mean, and so what's your stance on it now?
My stance on it now is that I try to stay away from it, and I see how successful he was with doing it, you know, sort of his own patented way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I realized about my life, was that the more I try to conform to the way they wanted me to get sober, which is a very not black and white thing when you're using drugs, you know that it's very complicated, and it's sort of like... they call it running your own show in AA, but there's also a thing to be said about like wanting to be in control of your own life and not being at the sort of helm or at the control of like, you know, other people's, you know, things for you.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting in the movie, there's really no, it doesn't seem to be any statement, positive or negative, about 12-step. That's how I took it.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, while I don't partake in AA anymore, it isn't to say that I didn't learn anything from it. I was able to stay sober. I mean, obviously, I think it's trial and error, right? So, like, I mean, if I had fallen off the wagon, then maybe I would have had to reconsider. But I've been on the wagon for a while now.
How long are you sober?
5 years. Mm-hmm. I've been sober since I've been to rehab. Mm-hmm. I've been able to, And I will say that my attitude towards AA changed, like when because this wasn't my first run at sobriety. I remember I used to go to AA and like listen to these people that were old, and I was like, they were usually older. I was, you know, 19 when I went to my first one. I was like, I'm not as bad as these people.
Right.
And then it took me a little while to realize you're not like them yet.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're just on, you know, page 3 of their story, and to learn to identify. So I got that, and AA helped me identify with people, but like, and I've internalized that, And every AA I went to, that sort of, you know, slowly but surely, I learned to identify, and you know, and another book that helped me was like, and it's going to sound pretentious as hell, but like Infinite Jest.
Oh, you read the whole thing?
I read it. I I'm not going to be one of these intellectuals who's like, I picked it up and I read it and I was just amazed. I was like, I picked it up, and I got to like 30 pages. And
footnotes,
I was like,
too?
Yep. And I was like, fuck this. This is too long and boring. And then I got sent to rehab, and I was like, maybe I should take another look.
You're like,
at
I've got some time.
Yeah, and I don't – that's the only place that I could have had enough time to read Infinite Jest.
And you did.
Yeah, and it really – it like he – I mean, he – David Foster Wallace just totally skewers like these people that think they're too smart for rehab or too smart for recovery. It's like – I had a bit of an attitude like I'm a college guy, I'm not really like these people. And then, you know, I learned, you know, that book really helped me because here's a guy who's way smarter than I am. That's like, you might want to fucking listen.
Right. I've tried twice. I tried once reading it and once with Audible because they don't have the footnotes in the audio version. Couldn't do it. So I'm impressed that you read the whole thing.
Yeah, he gave it to me and I was bored to tears by it, but that's just me.
Well, because I never got to the 12-step part. I only got through the, you know, the tennis thing at the beginning.
I couldn't
either.
The guy's sitting in the thing and he's thinking all these things. It's like, great, I don't know what you're saying right now.
I'm right there with you. talking about the movie, were there other movies about addiction and recovery that you admire, that you looked at, or that you didn't want it to be like, or anything like that?
There was none that I admired, and that was sort of the problem. Like, mm-hmm. I'd seen some of them, and they were all sort of like, not really posing. You know, we didn't write a thing that's anti-AA, but it's not pro. It's sort of posing. We tried to pose some new ideas about it.
Right.
And I didn't think there had been a movie like that. And I think that was sort of the goal, was to, you know, I don't know.
Do something that hadn't been done before.
Yeah. Or just like start to say like, hey, this is kind of interesting. This doesn't really work for everybody. What do you think about this?
Right.
Well, I think that a lot of drug movies or recovery movies, they either glorify drugs or they glorify recovery.
Right.
And having been through it, there's not a lot of glory to go around.
Right.
It's very inglorious. So I think we didn't want to, you know, make one of these sort of not to disparage these, you know, we didn't want to make a Wolf of Wall Street.
Right.
You know, that like because I mean, I saw that movie. I was like, damn! I wish I'd
get some coke
or some lewds.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh,
I was like, I was born
healthy?
Too late. You know.
Yeah. I miss those too. I know.
And so we definitely didn't want to. And then the other thing about rehab is like a lot of drugs that they would talk. They're like a lot of drug talk or war stories. I was like, oh man, I wish I tried that. You know.
You know, I got sober before OxyContin became a thing.
Oh, poor you.
I miss the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was the dark ages.
I was sort of like seeing that and I was just like, oh, I can't wait to go out and try that.
I think that that's a danger.
It's a danger, but you know, look, I'm still here.
Yeah.
I got a lot of experiences under my belt and, you get bored of that stuff after a while. If you really, get miserable with that life and you look around you and you're like, this is who I'm hanging out with. These are the places I'm at. And this is what I'm not doing with my life. And just like, if you really are mindful about your life and you really don't want to live that way anymore, there's always a way out of it, I believe.
Well, and your story got very, very dark and extreme, you know, more so than the average person that
it
I
did?
Meet. Yeah. 18 rehabs, starting when you were 14. And you had bouts of homelessness, right?
Bouts.
Right?
Yeah. It happened.
And at what point did it stop becoming fun? Because I'm assuming...
Right away.
Really?
Yeah, it was not really fun after a
while. At 14?
No, not then. But like, you know, around 17, 18. You know, when I got sent away the first time when I was 15, I had actually done a lot, but I had not done nearly as much. And I got put in a room with a heroin addict, and I stayed 126 days pillow talking with a heroin addict. And, you know, I then was like, what's that drug like, you know? And I was think, I'm never going to do that. And then you do it eventually. You eventually come around to kind of doing things that you didn't think you'd ever do.
Right.
And I've noticed that when you're surrounded by people that are so willing to go out and ruin everything just for this one thing, and you hear these, you get desensitized to these really hardcore things. And I look back now, I haven't done stuff like that in about 4 years. like that kind of hardcore stuff, and it just doesn't. I just never have thought about it because it's so. I was going through a really hard time in my life where I was so lost. I didn't know anything about myself or the world, and that's all I knew as a coping mechanism. And it wasn't so much the thing I was doing; it was like how extreme can I take it to just get outside of myself. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about like the constant drug itself, it was about the behavior. And when I was in that chaos, I was angry and resentful, but I wasn't like in despair because there was so much activity going on.
Right. You mean when you were using, you weren't in despair?
No, I mean there was definitely parts of despair, but it was like when you're homeless and you're outside and, you know, you're a guy has a 666 tattoo on the top of his head and, you know, it gets crazy and it's just like you get so distracted by the world and by the chaos of that life.
And Matt, was your story, your using story, as extreme or what was it like? And where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
My story is a little bit different. And I mean, I had some sort of things that I was repressing growing up. I have a lot of anxiety. I mean, something that we've talked about, you know, that gets discussed in the movie sort of obliquely is how drugs aren't the problem. They're the symptom of a problem. Mm-hmm. And I think I had a lot of anxiety that I was medicating with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept drinking and I kept getting in more and more because I would repress all these things and I would drink a lot. And when I drank, I started drinking in eighth grade maybe. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it just got worse and worse, like every other narrative. It's like, you know, I remember someone in AA actually said, like, the first drink I had, it was like I took off like a tight pair of shoes and I was like, ah, you know, I had that. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then I just got, it got worse and worse and I started acting out and like all that repression that I had in and then when I got to college, some tough things I was dealing with, a lot of tough issues, and with my family I was going through a lot, and I started drinking more, and I blacked out one day and I'd gotten in a lot of trouble, right? Mm-hmm. And they kept trying to send me to AA and I kept going and being like, I'm not, you know. And then it got to a place where I got thrown out of school and I got sent to rehab, and I was, you know, I'd had enough at that point. I was like, and something I learned in rehab, and since I got out, I was like, you know what? I've done these terrible things. I'm not an asshole because I did these things, but I'm an asshole if I keep doing these things and I don't learn from my mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, that's one of the reasons I don't drink, is just because it's like, you know, how, like, I just don't want to, you know. Definition of an insanity, right, is repeating this. Yeah. And I kept doing, it's not like I did it once and fucked up, and no, I, you know, I did the whole like, well, maybe if I just drink beer, you know, I've done that,
right,
you know, and, or, you know, maybe just stay away from tequila. I was like a scientist, you know, like, all right, so that didn't work.
Right. But all alcohol.
What?
Not drugs. It was.
Well, you know, it wasn't like I smoked some weed, but I'm the worst. I actually quit smoking weed before I stopped drinking, just because, like, it wasn't, not because I didn't like it, not because I like wanted to. It was just not fun for me. I would freak out. It was not the, like, alcohol was like, when I was the worst guy to smoke weed, I would freak out and like I was no fun. And it was just mainly alcohol, and I had a heart condition, so I was told, like, you know, don't do coke or don't do any uppers because you'll die. So I stay away from that stuff. But not because I was just like, I don't, probably don't want to die. So
Right.
You know.
Let's go back to the movie. So you're writing it in New York. You're printing up the pages, and then what were the next steps? Your dad was not going to be involved. You know, that was sort of a twist and a turn, right?
Yeah, we didn't even talk to him. We just started writing this thing, and we did a retooled version of the thing that we had done 3 years earlier in rehab, which was a slapsticky version of it. And it was from a 30-minute comedy to an hour-long drama. and which had comedy in it.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was like, let me take a look at it. And I gave it to him not thinking anything. But he really liked it. He really liked the tone of it, which was very different from the response he had before, which was, and then he liked this one. He was like, got us all pumped for it, and he was like, I want to take this to, you know, HBO and da 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 da. And we went to 8 different networks. Like, you know, we were so excited. We never had anything like this happen to us, and we got shot down from all 8 of them. And then once that was through, and we wiped our tears away, we went back and were. I was ready to throw in the towel. I was like, fuck this. I don't want to do another thing. I don't want to write about rehab anymore. I'm so sick of this.
Right.
And then for the next year, we had to write. He was like, you know, why don't you write a movie? And we were like, we don't know how to do that. And so we just tried to do it. And that, I think we both learned as we went along, was how to write a feature. Because a 30-minute comedy, you just put in some jokes, you put in some characters, and
it's
out.
Only 22 minutes,
and
yeah.
And you're out, yeah. And you don't have to tie a thing up. And this, it's like you have to come back around to everything that you put out there. And, yeah.
And so how long was that process? That entire process. So you go pitch it everywhere. It doesn't happen. You're rewriting it. And then the next thing that happened was...
Well, we were in despair. And then he said to us, look, you can make this into a movie.
Right.
He never said, make this into a movie that I'll direct.
Right.
He even said to me outside of, I don't remember what it was, but he was like, do you think you would ever direct this? And I was like, you're an idiot. He's not going to direct this. Like, we're just, I think he's helping us.
Right.
And I don't think he thought we could write it at that point. But then once we did write it and he liked it, we were never lobbying for it. He was really trying to encourage us through sort of, you know, this sort of sideways.
Right, right. To do it yourself and just providing notes and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, rewind, when we were in rehab, we wrote this thing longhand. And then when I got to a halfway house, I took like our little notebooks that we had and I put them on a computer.
Right.
And we gave it to him, and it was more like, you know, it's good that you kept busy in there. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like it was just like, and each time he wanted to go and do something with it, Nick would call me and I'd be like, he's doing what? Like, it was never like a, you know, it was more like, hey, why don't you turn it into a movie? Like, wouldn't that be fun? It was never like, and then, you know, we gave him a draft and it was like, he was like, no, this needs this thing. This needs work. And then it just got to a point that it was, Nick called me and he was like, he's going to show this to people. And I was like, he's really, you know, it was more like an exercise and something that we love to do, you know? And, I mean, the refrain for me is, what else am I doing? You know, this is fun and I like doing this. And I never had any, this has exceeded every expectation I've ever had. So.
And so suddenly it's, you're on set. It was a very short shoot, right? It was like just
20 days.
20 days. Were you guys on set for it?
Yeah. Yeah. And no, we got there like a few months before, you know, to like location scouting.
Where was it shot?
Utah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you were sort of like real life consultants, I would imagine, when they're specifically shooting scenes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and obviously people will go and have gone, oh, well, this is just Nick's story, right?
Yeah.
And there are elements, I understand, but it's really not the Nick Reiner story.
It's not my exact story, but seeing as how he went to one rehab and I went to 18, I had a little bit more experience with that.
Right.
And so I had a lot of stories. And so there's a lot of the stories in there, but when you create a script, you can't really just copy and paste your life. You have to cut it together in some, you know,
dramatic three structure way.
And some of the stuff I was like, I don't want that to be in there. You know, that's kind of hardcore. And some of the stuff I was like, I don't really care. And some of the stuff was from his life. And
some of the stuff we just made up.
A lot of it wasn't made up. It was derivative of some guy or some scenario or something. It was the scenes were created to service the funny in what we were seeing or the drama in what we were seeing. But it was all a derivative from some real sentiment, I would think.
Right, right. The guy who thought his email address was at email never made it in as a character, I guess.
No, he wasn't funny enough.
No. Yeah, I mean, he was never far from our minds. I would say that, like, the attitudes in that movie are, like, very much us, but, like, this is by no means an autobiography or it's just sort of like we distilled our experiences together into a narrative. And that was very important for us is for the story to work. We had to distance ourselves from the characters a little bit and be like, well, you know, I wouldn't do that. Well, maybe he would,
right.
You know, maybe this character would, you know, and we had to sort of do what was best for the story. And when our lives helped the story, we included it. And when our lives didn't help the story, we stayed out of it, I think.
And so some of it, you know, especially the intense father-son scenes, you know, I read that, you know, that last scene changed a lot as your relationship with your dad changed.
Uh-huh.
That's true.
Well, it's true in a sense that, like, I was not in a great place with my dad when this script started.
Right.
And he did not think I could do anything, and I didn't have much trust in him, and I think over time it really, like, was reflect, like, we didn't go through that necessarily, but what our growth in our relationship was sort of that trajectory in a sense. Like, we started in a very distrustful place, and sort of through working together on this hypothetical relationship, we worked on our own relationship, and we saw each other's sides of it.
Right. Okay, so after it's shot, it's, you know, anything from there? Oh, this is what I wanted to ask you. Casting. Did you have strong feelings? Did the people, when you're writing something, you're clearly envisioning some people, some specific actors.
We didn't have much say in that because it was like we kind of just sat in the back of the room and they would barely look at us. And then I think we put our two cents in here and there.
Did they listen? Did the people you were – you got to say
not
this.
Really. But there was one. I can't even tell the story.
I know what you're about to say, and it's definitely a no go.
Even though you told me the at email story,
this is worse.
This is way worse. Okay. It has nothing to do with. It's just like you know, Hollywood politics or whatever. You shouldn't.
Right.
But there was
juicy.
No, there was. Nah, I can't even go there. But
I would go there if it was just me.
Yeah, I am the police over here. But I'm. Yeah, but a hammer, yeah. But oh my God, are you kidding me? You get so much flack for that.
What? Could you do it without names?
No.
Yeah, I could do it without names.
Yeah.
Oh, there was an ask. There was a casting that was done, and it got recasted because one of the scenes called for a thing that someone didn't want to do. So. Luckily, we wound up with the right person. That's the abridged version.
God damn! I wish that I.
I'm getting yanked off the stage here by the people.
Shaking their heads.
No, but like, it all worked out for the best. Let me just put it that way. And wow, Nick, some real restraint there. I'm impressed.
They say restraint and pen and tongue. It's a recovery. Yeah, it's one of the tenets.
Yeah, I'm a pillar of recovery.
You know, my favorite thing is when I fucked up would say, progress, not perfection. And it's like, hey, I'm a little better.
Right.
I'm not perfect.
That's all we can do.
No, I mean, we were there in the casting, and yeah, we gave our two cents. But, like, I mean, obviously Rob was the quarterback, and I guess we were like...
Defense. I don't know sports.
We were the water boys. We filled up the Gatorade, and no, we had a great time. I mean, when we wrote it, I wasn't like, oh yeah, this would be great
Common.
For George Clooney.
We got to cast Common, yeah.
Or yeah, please. Right. Common was the farthest thing from my. I mean, because we didn't think it. This is all hypothetical. We weren't like, oh, this will be a great vehicle for Common,
right?
Or as he likes to be called, Rashid. But I didn't want to, you know. To me, he's just Rashid. You know.
Really, you gotta call him that.
That's what
he's so close with him that he can call him that, Rashid.
Is that true? Did you guys become like BFF?
It sounds like he's gotten really close with him, but I don't know.
Are you a little threatened?
Yeah, I was really threatened by their relationship, and I wish I had something more along those lines with Common. Sorry, Rashid, as you call him.
So what's next for you guys? Are you continuing to write together? Do you have you know, plans for the next thing?
The mic has been handed to me. I think we're going to ride this wave. This was a lot for us as friends.
We both moved out here. And
from New York, you mean?
He moved out here from New York, and I am here still.
Right.
And we started working on different things to sort of spread our wings once we got out here, find a little independence. And that's not to say that we'll never work again together, but... Right. You know, this is a huge undertaking. I think that's what he's trying to say, that we went through quite a lot together during this.
Yeah.
Did you guys fight?
Yeah. Everyone, you know, the people, like nice people will be like, oh, you guys are like brothers. It's like, no, fuck him. But
that's what brothers are like.
I know, I hate it when people said that.
Right.
But no, we're cool now. But like, yeah, we definitely fought.
But did you have like a not speaking period?
Like 3 days ago, I was talking to my sister, and she goes, you know, those fights you got in with Matt were insane. Those were the craziest fights I ever saw. So
about like this character has to do that, or
no,
more like exactly. You're not, you're being
like,
selfish.
You didn't show up. I bought you a pack of cigarettes last week and you didn't do it this week. And just, you know, really stupid shit like that.
There are writing partners I know that have a couples therapist that they go to, two women. To mediate, because it's, you know, it's a pretty intense relationship.
It is intimate.
Not to be sexist, but I wouldn't think that two male writing partners would have as many issues.
It's more like...
We're like little girls.
We're open. Like we'll explode at each other. Like, we don't really carry it for that long. Like,
right.
I remember, like, Nick was, like, had beef with someone, and he was like, I confronted the guy about this, and I was like... He said, I couldn't hold it in any longer. I was like, we just got here. Like, you held it in for what, 20 minutes?
Right.
You know, it's like, I remember, you know, it's like a lot of just screaming. And I remember the smoked salmon incident.
Oh, yeah.
It was a two towel.
I left.
I'm going to tell it biasly.
I'm going to tell it how it was.
At least we get the other side, though.
Nick told me, Nick was putting some smoked salmon on his bagel. And I said, yo, I would like some smoked salmon. Can you not put it away? And Nick was like, of course. I won't put it away, but it's on you to put the smoked salmon away. I know this is riveting stuff. It's to put the smoked salmon away. Right. And
Salmon Gate.
And I didn't put the smoked salmon away. And then Nick's mom came in and was like, what the fuck? Like, everything's a mess in here. And then Nick started screaming at me because I didn't put the smoked salmon away. And it got so real.
Really?
And
that's the long and the short of it, is that he didn't put it away. I said, it's really easy. Just make sure you put it in the fridge, which is a foot away from your face. And you couldn't even do that, among like 20 other things before that he wasn't able to do. But that's fine. We're shit talking, smack talk. It's all part of the fun.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, part of being brothers. Yeah, sorry, did that annoy you? That's pretty much it. Is there anything you want to add for, you know, a lot of the listeners are people who are wanting to get sober, struggling to, you know, be sober, that kind of thing. Is there anything you want to sort of tell them or impart?
I was just thinking about this. This might not be helpful to anybody, but when I was going through a lot of this and I was going to many rehabs and I was talking to many people and listening in on a lot of groups, they weren't as helpful as this one random tennis coach that I had when I was a very little kid. And he said to me that he used to do a lot of cocaine, like he did an 8-ball a day. And then now he is, you know, drinks a beer once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that concept was fascinating to me. As opposed to the life sentence of The Walking Dead, you're bit. Once you have it, you're never going back to the way you were. And that was always daunting to me, whether that's true or not true, scientifically, spiritually, I don't know. But that was always a little daunting for me to wrap my head around. So for that, like him to tell me that story was the most helpful thing I ever heard. And it was like,
I mean, to go off what he's saying, just I remember I had trouble with labels, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I don't want a salmon alcoholic, because then you get this thing in your head of like, I don't know, Barney from The Simpsons, you know, that you just start thinking like, oh, you just start thinking of people brown bagging on the street and these late, like, I mean, it's just a stigmatized thing. I think if you could unload that, you know, and sort of just say, if you can sort of try to unload that, and approach it in a way like where you don't care what other people think. I think the one thing that helped me with about rehab was, realizing that these drug addicts were like people, and I became friends with them and realized, you know what, being a drug addict doesn't make you a lesser person. It's just something that these people are. And usually, I mean, and I also, cause I had this, when I went to rehab, I was like, I don't belong here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't belong here. I'm better than these people. And then I realized, you know, like these are fuck ups or whatever. And I realized, you know, a lot of, like, and Nick included, like a lot of drug addicts are just like, I've noticed, are incredibly sensitive people.
Right.
Like they got really big hearts a lot, like I've known. And that's why they medicate, I think, is to deal with that pain. And once I realized that, you know, having these having a problem doesn't make you a bad person. It just means it's something that it just is what it is, as stupid as that sounds. And to sort of, if you unloaded that addict or that alcoholic with meaning, if you just try to take the meaning out of that word, it just makes life a whole lot easier.
Right. Do you think it's just sensitivity that drives people to do drugs and drink excessively and that kind of thing?
I think if you're dealing with some, I don't know. I'm just saying, from my experience, a lot of drug addicts are very sensitive, very, they feel deeply.
Right.
And people who feel deeply, sometimes have to try to numb that. And I think that was like eye opening to me to realize that, you know, to sort of put a human face behind this, you know, drug addict or alcoholic and just treat it like any other problem and not this stigmatized thing. I don't know.
Right. And not something that you have to wear for the rest of your life.
Right. The scarlet letter aspect was really, it's like, oh, I don't want to be an alcoholic. But then it's like, once you get in the room and you meet these people,
right,
they're not like Barney from The Simpsons or, you know, some guy from a Eugene O'Neill play, you know, these are,
right,
or some drunk in the gutter.
Some people get almost addicted to making it work in AA, and they get so pent up that I've seen people die because they try to follow that motto. And what I was trying to say by what I was saying before is that, you know, among all the things that people try to say at me, the one thing I heard was something that was so offhanded and so hopeful,
right,
in the way that, like, this guy could turn his life around without having to think about all this stuff and the,
right,
ins and outs. And, like, it's, like, enough for me, at least,
right,
you know. And everybody deals with this differently.
Yes.
And, you know, that's – I've seen a ton of people, and I can't speak for them, but I can only speak for myself. And it's not like I didn't give it a shot. It's not like I haven't been around,
right,
and seen this stuff. And it's just how I feel about it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of the point, is that everybody is different. It is not a sort of one-size-fits-all.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about our brains. Like, how could,
yeah,
all of our brains be treated in the same way? And, you know, and honestly, when I first got sober, I was one of those people. I wasn't, like, out there, you know, like, put your cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth or whatever they, yeah, say old-timers say. But I really didn't understand that there were people who could do it and be healthy and happy without that. And that is something that I've probably only come to understand in the last 5 years. And it's sort of,
I never had that, like, I thought it was better than,
right,
I always came in and I was like, you know, these people have gone through stuff and everybody has, you know, stuff that they're, and I found them a lot cooler than the people you'd see in the street normally that are just average everyday people. These people have been through stuff.
So. Yeah, exactly. What a friend of mine says is, it's not that we're having more feelings than other people, but that we prioritize our feelings so much. It's sort of like, I feel this, and it's just so important. It sort of rules the day,
yeah,
rather than just like,
yeah,
oh, I feel this. I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I feel sad. Whatever it is. Okay, that's it, unless you guys have anything else to add.
That's all.
Go see the movie.
Go see it.
All right, so that was Nick Reiner, Matt Alisafon. Give me credit for continuing to try to pronounce that name. I think I got better on the third time. Go see their movie, Being Charlie. It is now out. It is about addiction and recovery. It is based on their experiences, two guys who met in rehab. Pretty inspiring rehab story. So go check it out. Go check out After Party Magazine. Sign up for the After Party newsletter. And I'll see you next time.